International explorer, archaeologist, and author Jonathan Gray has traveled the world to gather data on ancient mysteries. Over the past 37 years, he has penetrated some largely unexplored areas, including parts of the Amazon headwaters. He also led expeditions to the bottom of the sea and to remote mountain and desert regions of the world. In the course of his explorations, Jonathan began to uncover evidence of surprising out-of-place artifacts. According to what he was taught at school, these were impossible. They simply should not exist. And these were not just isolated anomalies. There was a global pattern to them, suggesting an ancient worldwide civilization of astonishing proportions. His book, Dead Man's Secrets, catalogs more than 1,000 evidences of a lost super science and technology, including dozens of achievements ahead of our day. He's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome to the program. How are you?
Thank you, George. I'm thrilled to be on again to speak with you. I appreciate your invitation. Thank you.
It's been a little over a year. Can you believe how quickly time flies?
It doesn't seem that long, George.
No,
it certainly goes faster every day you live.
Hey, I've got to tell you that I am so fascinated by your subject matter and some of the things you've investigated. I was just so fortunate that we were able to get you back when we have here, Jonathan. If we can, let's talk a little bit about some of this lost technology. But more importantly, how you started stumbling across it. Tell us the story.
Well, I suppose it began when I was only 10 years old, George. I was reading magazines about explorers and lost cities and so on. It always had fascinated me since as far as I can remember. And then I read about the British explorer Fawcett, who went into the Amazon jungle and came out with wild tales of pygmies with blowpipes and poison darts that were guarding a city choked in vines and jungle. And he reported this to a British scientific organization, and then he returned to South America to try to obtain hard evidence of what he was talking about. And he vanished. That was about 1925 or thereabouts, George.
What do you mean he vanished?
He was never heard. He and his son went in and they just disappeared. Nothing more was heard of them.
Oh, my.
I'm not surprised, though, George, because in that jungle, you can get lost and think you're never coming out. That's happened to me a few times.
Did it scare you?
Yes, it's more scary than the wild man or the wild beasts or the insects or the piranhas or the whatever. To think that you're lost, a compass will not help you because the jungle is so thick. You can be just 10 feet away from a swirling river and not even hear it because the sound is soaked up by the jungle.
Oh, my God. Okay, so there you are in a jungle looking for things. Are you alone? Do you have a team with you when these were going on?
Well, on this first occasion I can think of when I was really frightened, I had a half-caste Ecuadorian, half-native, half-Ecuadorian soldier given me by the Ecuadorian government. He carried a rifle, the only weapon that my party had. It was only myself, the only person who could speak English. He could speak native and he could also speak Spanish. And the other two people on the team were two natives from a nearby village. It was a two-day journey to get their services. And the military outpost that was in a clearing in the middle of the jungle sent out some soldiers to recruit two carriers for me. And these men came out and they became my carriers right through the journey.
Well, Jonathan, did you know what you were looking for or were you just exploring?
Well, I was looking for lost cities. I mean, this man, Fawcett, really captured my imagination, and I guess I was ambitious, George. I wanted to pick up where he left off and see what went wrong.
Well, but how do you start looking for something that's lost?
You read up all you can about it first. Every source, every report, true or false, and you try to sift the true from the false and then say, okay, where do I start? What do I get? How am I going to get in? What equipment do I need? What dangers will I face, and if so, how am I going to trade my way out or talk my way out of these? And first of all, you ensure that you can get in, that you can get out again, and then you start thinking, now, what am I going to look for?
So even though some of these stories could have been myths, there might be some truth to it, and you try to digest that, Jonathan, try to sort through these things you hear to try to figure out, okay, what's the best spot, what's the best region I need to go in to begin to investigate? Is that how that works?
Exactly. That's true.
Okay, some of the lost technology that you have illustrated, that you've sent us, and of course that is in your book, Dead Man's Secrets. Tell us about this, because you've provided us some things that are quite frankly startling that they existed thousands of years ago. As you began to uncover some of this, I mean, what did you first of all think? I mean, did you try to rule out the fact that maybe, like the lens that you sent us a picture of, that maybe it was 20 years old and somehow was found in this region and couldn't be that old?
Yes, it does enter your mind. I actually began to see these anomalies, not only things that I was stumbling over, George, but reports from so many other people. At first, it was just one or two, and I pushed them aside because I had focused on other things. And as I continued investigating these other things, more anomalies began to pop up until it was no longer an isolated thing that you could just dismiss. But apparently there was something here that had to be taken notice of, and it turned into hundreds, then into thousands, perhaps even tens of thousands. And I could see here there's a gap in our knowledge. People have to know about this. It got me so excited I just had to sit down and collate it. And eventually Dead Men's Secrets came as a result of that. That was over 35 countries of research.
Jonathan, Michael Cremo writes in his book, Forbidden Archaeology, that past civilizations could be millions of years old on this planet. Some of the artifacts that you found, of course, are thousands of years old. And, you know, that's pretty dramatic all by itself. But do you think at all that his thoughts, his theories of past civilizations on this planet being millions of years old could be possible?
Well, I don't like to get into speculation, George. I know that it's very nice to think and wonder about millions of years back, and there are lots of theories concerning that. But as an archaeologist, I have to keep my head out of the air and my feet on the ground, and I go for evidence. Archaeology is about physical evidence, and I would say evidence does not take us back more than thousands. When you get beyond that, we're getting into speculation, and his speculation, man, I love the man and I love what he's doing, and the world needs to be shaken up, and if it wasn't for Michael Cremo, half the world wouldn't know what they do know now. And I support Michael in every way, but I would say let him go to that part of it. I'll stick to the evidence, and the evidence goes back thousands anyway.
Okay, and would you say thousands? Roughly how far back?
I'd say the furthest back you can really go is about 5,000 as far as solid history goes, solid evidence and confirmed evidence that you can prove dates for.
Okay, let's use that tonight then as a possible beginning point of 5,000 years. At that point, some of the speculation again, and I know you're not going to go there, but with the science that you've uncovered, what does a planet look like about 5,000 years ago, and what regions of the planet are we talking about?
Well, we're looking at a planet that was disturbed in that period, in that millennium, with a great worldwide disaster, George. I have no doubt about that whatsoever, because the clocks were reset, and there are so many ways that if we had time to talk about that, where we can actually pinpoint that millennium as being a time when a civilization was wiped out and a new beginning took place.
You've got 3 hours with me today, Jonathan. You've got all the time in the world.
Okay.
So we're talking about 3000 BC, basically, right?
Roughly that, yeah.
Okay. In your opinion, what kind of calamity might have occurred?
Well, it was a disaster in which the planet was tilted on its axis and its orbit was altered. And it was an earth-changing, ecology-changing disaster that probably affected every square inch of our planet. And the civilizations that came up after that began at the top, not at the bottom. They began with all the knowledge to start with that had been passed on by the survivors from the previous civilization.
I would guess that in order for this planet to undergo some kind of major orbital change, we had to have been hit by something.
Yes, I do believe that we have an outside force involved here. Velikovsky was rather much on the mark, I believe, when he said that the Earth could not tilt on its axis from its own power within itself. Anything that occurred on the planet itself could not tip it on its axis, nor change the orbit. It would have to be an outside force, such as a flyby comet or something else, that would have tilted the Earth on its axis and would have caused such a breaking up of the crust of the Earth that thousands of volcanoes would have burst out. Great underground water basins would have exploded to the surface, and the former canopy that was similar to Venus that was around our Earth at that time and gave us a nice climate from pole to pole was disrupted and collapsed on the Earth. And it was just a convulsion in which seas and continents were turned up together.
What would have happened to human life? What would have happened to animal life on this planet, Jonathan, 5,000 years ago when this catastrophe occurred?
It would have been a total wipeout except for those that were ready for it.
Like they might have had some advanced knowledge about it?
Yeah. Well, if there was a total wipeout, I would say there must have been some because we're here today.
unless we came from other sources, which is a possibility.
Well, I do know that's a theory, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, we're getting back probably to the 600 legends worldwide in all our nations, from North America, South America, Australia, Asia, Africa, the Pacific Islands, all stating that there was a global catastrophe of water and fire. Fire came first, then the water. And I guess this is where the story of Noah's Ark comes into the picture.
Is it possible that maybe some huge asteroid plummeted into the planet, landed into the ocean, and not only, you know, created some catastrophe in terms of fire planet-wide, but also major flooding just because of the tsunami that might have occurred when this thing would splash into the ocean?
Well, we know what a tsunami can do, don't we?
Oh, exactly.
I would think, George, that there is good evidence that it was even greater than that, the disaster. I'm not dismissing that an asteroid may have come crashing in, quite possibly. But it's bigger than this, that the whole crust of the Earth was ripped to shreds. And you've got the Great African Rift, a rift that goes three-quarters of the way around the world, for example.
All right, these regions that we're talking about, where there were civilizations prior to the catastrophe, would have been where? Throughout the entire planet or primarily in Africa?
Throughout the whole planet, pretty well, I would say. There's evidence of buried civilization in Australia, North America, Europe, Africa, Asia. It's pretty much a global thing.
In your opinion, what kind of intelligence are we talking about on the planet 5,000 years ago? Obviously, if they had some high technology, they knew some things.
Oh, yes. We have people. We have actually a legend. I'm going to start with a legend, then get down to some evidence, if that's okay with you.
Absolutely, yeah.
We have a legend passed down to the survivors who wrote books in India, stating that the previous population had warning that this was going to happen, and they were hoping and planning to rocket privileged people off the planet to escape it. Now, we don't know what happened to those so-called privileged people, but we know that they must have had the technology to even consider it.
And how would they have known? Unless maybe somebody told them?
Somebody must have told them, yeah.
Could have seen something coming this way. They probably couldn't alter it. But they probably predicted, you know, as we have now a near-Earth tracking system, we were looking at an asteroid, for example, Jonathan, that's going to come very close to the planet. Originally, they thought it might hit us, but it's going to come very close to the planet 2029. So that's a 17-year jump. Maybe if this planet was being monitored by extraterrestrials, they might have warned some of the people that, hey, folks, 10, 15, 30 years out, this is going to happen. Is it possible it could have occurred that way?
Well, that is a possibility, George. We're getting back to the legends of the world here again, where they all pretty much agree that there was advance warning given. And the legends virtually will say that God chose right living people to be the survivors so that they could give mankind a better start, because the world was about to destroy itself with violence and world wars. You know what I mean?
Yes, and would you think that this advance warning then may have come a little more directly as opposed to some kind of spiritual or divine intervention?
Could have been a combination of both, George.
Well, that's true too.
Certainly there was enough time to prepare, and the knowledge was given that it was going to be a waterborne disaster, because a ship was prepared at least, and animals, in other words, representative animal life was preserved along with it. So, I mean, it couldn't have, these creatures could not have survived without some kind of protection, and such protection was prepared.
These high civilizations around the planet, then, would you, based on some of the things you've uncovered, could you assume that these civilizations around the planet were all pretty much technologically advanced at about the same rate?
It would appear to be so, yeah. Down in Australia, something similar has been found underground to what's been found in the United States, evidence of perhaps of motor technology, machinery, and so on.
What was found in Australia? This is fascinating.
Yes, down in the coal mines of the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, a miner has told me that he was involved in a discovery 400 feet below the surface of the earth some time ago, and it looked like very similar to what was found in California, some kind of device, electrical device, resembling a modern spark plug that we have in motor cars.
Generally, then, though, what has happened? So we found some small things. Where's the big stuff? They must have had big technology, big devices, machinery. What happened to this stuff?
I do have some pictures. I should have perhaps emailed one for your website, George. It's enormous. It's a piece of machinery that I can't identify, neither has anyone who's seen it. It was found in the United States. It's got a picture of a dumpster right next to it, which is dwarfed by it. And it was found on a military compound where excavation was being done for underground tunnels. And there were several of them found, and they were, after being photographed, they were buried. I have got one photograph of it.
Any speculation on its age?
No, except that it was probably buried about the same time as the disaster that buried all the other things hundreds of miles away.
So thousands of years old as well.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you can definitely send that to Lex at lex@coast2coastam.com, just like you sent some of the other images.
Please do.
Okay, and maybe, Lex, you can get those up while we're conducting our chat with Jonathan tonight. I mean, this is fascinating. So the civilizations, for example, in Egypt, Samaria, and other areas, all appeared suddenly, and then they simply disappeared suddenly? Was it that fast?
They appeared very suddenly and disappeared fairly steadily, gradually.
All right, let's talk about that when we come back. Jonathan Gray, our guest right here on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan, can you tell us a little bit about the lens picture that you supplied us on the coasttocoastam.com website? Where was that found?
It's found in a Libyan tomb west of Egypt, dated to about 2000 BC.
Looks like it was made from glass, right?
Yes, from glass. In fact, there have been other lenses found in different places too. One was found in Northern Territory of Australia. One's been found on the seabed off the coast of Ecuador in the remains of a drowned city. One's been found in Asia. We're not finding a lot of those. They're very small things, but there's enough to see that there was a consistent knowledge of the laws of optics. And, George, it appears to me that if you've got a lens, it's used either to magnify something that's big or magnify something that's small. In other words, telescopes or optical microscopes are the next step.
That's right, one or the other. And did it look like it might have fit inside some kind of a tube or anything like that?
Well, it's possible. you don't just have a lens made for nothing. And I do believe that if we go to some ancient drawings, which will complement this, you can go across to South America and see on ancient engravings somebody looking through a long tube at the stars. Then you have, for example, the Nazca lines, which many of our listeners probably have heard of.
In Peru.
Down in Peru, yes. And there's a spider there. You can only see it from the air, of course, George, and you look at the spider and you'll see it's copulating. It's in a form in which a spider can only... it's only one spider that does that. It's a South American spider that is in that particular shape in the form of copulation. And it can only be seen with a microscope. Now, for this to be seen and discovered by modern science and to be known only to be seen with a microscope suggests that these people knew more than we give them credit for.
You know, that's a good point, and I did not know that at all. That is a pretty dramatic point, to tell you the truth. The theory of these high civilizations, tell me, in your opinion, Jonathan, what you think they were and how they lived, and then what happened.
The original Mother X civilization, would you be referring to before the Great Event?
Yes.
Okay. I believe we're looking at a technology that is in many ways in advance of our own day, George. Because, and we can judge it largely by the state of Egypt when it first sprang up with no predecessor to speak of that we could find. And the same with the Sumerians and the Indus Valley civilization and the Mayans and the Northwestern European civilization. These all sprang up roughly at the same time, round about 3000 BC, all of them with no evidence of any transition whatsoever between their civilization and any primitive forebears, and with very many common points which suggested they all came from a common beginning. Now, that's the common beginning that we're looking for.
Okay.
A beginning that had electric light. I'm talking this now only by extrapolating from what we can see after the event. That these five civilizations sprang up with these things. Electricity, the knowledge of flight, the use of machinery, the very highest medical knowledge and tools to operate on their patients with modern technology desires like we have today to achieve certain things which we can only do today. Tunnel building systems, which we're only beginning to achieve now, tunnels that can go for hundreds of miles, with glassy walls in many places, and I've been down into some of these myself. You have also the knowledge of atoms, the knowledge of mathematics and fractions of mathematics that go down to the 1,000th part of a second, which suggests that these people not only were able to calculate to that degree, but they must have had a reason for calculating it. What were they trying to measure? Today, the only equivalent is the splitting of an atom and the speed with which atomic reactions take place.
Well, is it possible that this catastrophe might have been a worldwide atomic war or something like that?
There are legends that a world war was in progress, George, at the same time, and that this war was interrupted by the great disaster.
Ah, interrupted. Okay. Now, with the technology that we're talking about, do you believe the Egyptians used this high technology to build the pyramids?
I do believe the pyramids were built with high technology, yes. What I was taught at school is just a fable. And you were probably taught the same.
Yes.
That they used thousands and thousands of slaves pulling along with ropes up a long, long ramp. And, oh boy, you'd need more material in the ramps than you would in the pyramid. So what's the point of it?
You said that it appeared that these high civilizations just appeared suddenly, already developed, no evidence of primitive beginnings. So how do you explain that?
I can only explain it, George, by the the suggestion here that these people began where the pre-flood civilization left off, and that the survivors had a knowledge of the world that they were escaping from, or being rescued from, which they passed on to their descendants as they began to multiply and set up new civilizations again, Egypt, Indus Valley, Sumeria, and so on.
Do you believe these were Earthlings, or did they come from some other place in the universe?
By the relics they've left behind, there's a clear pattern of a human type of creation here in this. I don't think we have to go off the earth to find the intelligence nor the methods of technology that we find.
Okay, for them to possess the kind of technology they had, though, to me, it indicates that there must have been some pattern of growth of knowledge especially, yet you continue to say, and this is what's fascinating, that it seemed like a sudden appearance. So what did you mean by sudden?
What I'm looking at here is Egypt, say, for a start. Egypt sprang into existence fully developed with a fantastic ready-made high society. You've got enormous temples, great cities, pyramids of overwhelming size, colossal statues with tremendous expressive power at the very start of Egyptian history. Luxurious tunnels and tombs, streets paved like our streets today, flanked with magnificent sculptures, sewage systems, a decimal system at the very start, a ready-made writing at the very beginning, a court system which shows all the indications of well-defined precedents, an army, a civil service, all minutely organized, even specialist classes, all at the very beginning.
Now,
as though this was not something they had to think up slowly, but it was already there in their minds when they started it.
What does that tell you, then? How did this happen?
It tells me that these were the survivors of something that had been wiped out that had these things.
Aha. Okay. And those civilizations might have taken some longer time periods to evolve.
Yes, of course.
Okay. And then maybe that's where CREMO comes in terms of that time period of a million years or so.
Well, CREMO's got an interesting point there, George, and as I said, I support the man in his book and everything. I love what he's doing. I think here we're getting into theories and speculation, and, you know, it hasn't really taken us long. Let's look back here in our own day. The Industrial Revolution started about 300 years ago, would it be? Something like that?
Well, you know what? Yeah, maybe 200.
All right, 200. That's even faster. Look how far we've come, George, in just 200 years. If the human intelligence is there and the creativeness is there, there's really not much to stop mankind advancing pretty fast if he's intelligent. Already.
Well, that's true. And as a matter of fact, the real push was just the past 100 years. You know, the 1900s is when things really started to grow and explode. To the point where it seems like they magnify themselves all the time. You're absolutely right. In the past, that same kind of growth of evolution could have occurred as well. As we get into some of this other discussions, underground tunnels and what have you, the thing that keeps cropping up, though, Jonathan, is, okay, was this catastrophe so big that it obliterated all the technology? Where did it go? Is it buried thousands of feet under the surface? Where is it?
Oh, that's a very good question. I love that. look at the American coal fields. In the last 100 or 200 years, amazing things have been found down coal mines. We're just within stone's throw from where you are, George. We have, for example, bells that have been found deep in coal, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of feet down. And you can ring those bells today. They're still as good as they were when they were buried. Iron pots, gold chains. Down in Philadelphia, there was a mine which went down, I think it was about 3 kilometres, 2 miles mm-hmm. down below the surface of the ground. And when the workmen were tunnelling horizontally from that distance down, they came slap bang against a man-made wall with polished like glass with hieroglyphics on it. Now, in my thinking, that can only have been a victim of that great disaster. I mean, if you've got 3 kilometres of stuff piled over the top of you, which was forests buried and burning while they were being washed into place, you've got a great disaster. In other words, a man-made technology destroyed in disaster that wipes out the forests and just wipes out the surface of the earth at the same time.
And buries everything.
Buries everything.
So there could be, theoretically, a couple miles below the surface, there could be buried planes, there could be buried ships. Who knows what's there?
Who knows, yes. In fact, George, ships have been found deep inside mountains.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. There was a ship found in a mine in Peru a few years ago, way in underneath the Andes Mountains.
And the only way it could get in there was to have been buried in there, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And another one was found in Switzerland, and this was way in under a mountain, and there were men inside it, chained. Probably galley slaves of some sort, if they had them in those days. They were chained to their boat, and the mountain was over the top of them.
It was sudden. Whatever happened was pretty instant, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Evidently.
Jeez, this is just... why doesn't mainstream media pick this up? These are incredible stories.
Well, it's like a lot of things that are not popular in today's theory, which reigns through the media and the schools. There's an entrenched view that history happened a second way. I mean, we're familiar with what we were taught in school, and that's the only way that's allowed to be taught in the schools. Anything which will challenge that is going to challenge it's going to challenge reputations, degrees, financial grants, and the education system itself.
Jonathan, where does Atlantis fit into this scheme here?
Well, that always interests me, George, and I have studied it a little bit, and I think there are two ways of looking at it. There are similarities to the Atlantis story, similar to the story of the global flood, if we compare it with the flood legends. It may be a version of the pre-world flood, but my opinion really is that it's something that happened after that. There have been a lot of geological upheavals since the Great Flood. There has been an adjustment. If the Earth was tipped on its axis and everything was thrown out of alignment and everything was out of balance in that great disaster, there would be hundreds of years of a settling down, realignment process taking place. And there does appear to be evidence of violent centuries after the disaster. The people of Egypt, Sumeria, Indus Valley would have heard of these disasters because they were occurring in the early parts of their civilization while the earth was still settling down in many areas. And one of those events would have been the raising of the Andes. Maybe we can talk about that later on. There was a city 12,000 feet above sea level now that used to be a seaport.
And it just got pushed up.
It got pushed up. And by the way, you may be aware that in the tsunami of December 26 last year,
right,
was it the Straits of Sunda that goes through that part of the world north of Sumatra? I think so. There were areas where that seabed was raised 4,000 feet.
And they're talking today that the entire planet was shaken when this occurred.
Yes. Now, Atlantis could very well have gone down in such a disaster after the flood. It could have been a post-flood civilization contemporaneous with Egypt, Greece, and these others that went under at the time when one of these adjustments was taking place. I'm quite happy to accept that because I know these adjustments were happening.
Have you read some of the works of Zachariah Sitchin?
I have, yes.
Well, and he believes that the Sumerians, of course, tell an incredible story of visitation and chaos it's all very possible. All of this is related to each other.
Yes, there must be connections here. We've got a situation where there was a world that was wiped out, and then our world, which was left as a wreck, and through, from which adjustments have been taking place ever since. Beautiful world still we have, but nothing like it must have been beforehand.
Yeah, I keep thinking, Jonathan, what would happen if some kind of catastrophe hit us now and only a few of us was we were left. I couldn't build a rocket ship. I couldn't build a car. You know, I'd have to use whatever devices were still around, if possible. So it's very conceivable that if something happened to an ancient intelligent technology and civilization, that the survivors, you know, merely had a few things that they could use and tap into. That's very possible, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it certainly is. And I would think that Egypt, Sumeria, and these other civilizations that sprang up later, wonderful as they were just an echo, a very feeble echo of the world that had been before.
These survivors, Jonathan, of the catastrophe, how did they make it? How did they survive? Might they have been in tunnels? And again, like you were talking about, some of them may have been forewarned, but those may have left. What happened to these people?
Well, we do find the remains of people all over the world buried, just like this technology we find buried. Certainly, bodies are being found all over the world. There was one up in, I think it was Virginia. I was given this report third hand, and Virginia, I think, is the place where it was found. There was, are there coal mines up in Virginia?
Yes, I believe there are.
Okay, I think it is Virginia we're talking about. And this is reported by coal miners in a mine over that way.
What did they find?
Who came into an air pocket, way deep under the coal, hundreds of feet down. And in the ceilings... Are we getting into some music now for a break?
No, that's okay. What did they find?
Okay, they found the remains of humans in the ceilings, mixed up in the coal.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Just blended right in.
Blended right in with the coal. In other words, there was a civilization of people destroyed at the same time as the trees that were buried over them.
Something happened, Jonathan. Back in a moment, right after the top of the hour. Jonathan, you also supplied us with an ancient map. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Oh, yes. This map was found in the Ural Mountain area of Russia. There were reports of these strange stones up in a certain village up in the north, and scientists from Moscow University went up there, and apparently there were several hundred of these. Seven were taken down to Moscow and examined, and they identified them as aerial type maps of large areas of that northern part of the continent, a huge water dam, a huge reservoir dam, and a canyon, roads going across, and so on. In other words, these maps are large-scale maps of large areas as though taken from the air, but the interesting thing is that they're three-dimensional. And I believe the American Air Force is only now beginning to get into this kind of mapping of three dimension, and it hasn't perfected it quite yet. So here we have something very advanced going back quite a few thousand years.
How accurate are they?
As accurate as can be determined, that they would have had to have been done from the air and not from the ground.
Now, what does that tell you? That we had flying machines, or that extraterrestrials came here and basically help draw a map for us?
Well, there seems to be evidence that man did have the knowledge and the theoretical knowledge as well as the ability to fly in the past.
Do you think, Jonathan, it's possible that we were so advanced that we had rocket ships, that we went to the moon? Maybe our astronauts saw some of these ancient artifacts there. They don't want to say anything to us.
Well, George, the first flight to the moon in which Neil Armstrong walked on the moon...
1969.
Yeah, 1969. I remember exactly where I was. I was walking down Hay Street in Perth in Western Australia when I heard the news, and I was listening to it on my radio. And The news was given at that time from the name of the guy who was orbiting the moon. I can't remember his name. Well,
that was Michael Collins, I think.
Michael Collins, fine. He was giving a live report back to NASA, and 11 minutes of that report was cut out of all later broadcasts, but that 11 minutes was explosive. I mean, he was talking for hours, but 11 minutes were cut out. And you know what he was talking about in those 11 minutes?
I think you're going to tell us.
He was reporting what appeared to him to be pagoda-type buildings on the moon.
As he circled the moon with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on the moon, he was reporting back to NASA that he was seeing structures of buildings on the moon. Is that what you're saying?
That is correct. And he reminded me of something I had I'd been researching, actually, in my very earliest explorations, because I only started exploring the Amazon just before that. And one of the first things that came to my notice was that the Chinese were talking about flying. And this was one of the things I was pushing out of my mind, because to me it just sounded like nonsense. It just sounded like fiction. But the more you go into this and find out the history of Chinese thinking and literature, the more evident it is the Chinese knew a lot. Now, there was an emperor of China who made it a law to punish by death any man who wrote fiction. In other words, if it wasn't true history, he was not allowed to live. Now, in the historical writings of China, many of which have now been translated into English since the Nixon cultural exchange took place, there are records of emperors sending astronauts to the moon. And they describe the moon in these ancient works going back 2,000 or 3,000 years. They describe it as glassy-like, exactly as our present astronauts have. They describe it as being cold. And they describe the Earth as seen from the moon. They describe things precisely as our own astronauts have described them, and which we would not have known had we not sent astronauts there. And one thing they did describe is that they built a structure which they called the Palace of Cold because of the temperature. Now, I don't know what Collins saw when he was looking down, but I like to piece things together, and maybe I am entering into speculation, but the Chinese say they built something on the moon. Collins said he saw something on the moon. I'm just wondering if he saw what they built.
And here they are wanting to go back to the moon again some thousands of years later.
Yes.
Well, I got to tell you, it's an incredible story if that indeed happened that way. But I have always suspected that they saw something, and they were so shocked. Some have, again, speculated that Armstrong might have seen some UFOs, and he didn't want to. He just couldn't talk about it when he came back, and therefore he clammed up all these years. But I always wondered what would happen if they had gotten there, taken a look at some of these things, saw these structures, maybe saw even some ships or what was left of ships, craft. And I bet somewhere along the line, Jonathan, they have some incredible pictures.
Oh, yes, I'm sure there are, but we're not being shown them.
So at least you believe we went to the moon in 1969, as I do.
I certainly do. I think we had the technology to do it, and it seems that they must have had some technology like that. Otherwise, how could they have described it so perfectly?
So they were able to map three-dimensionally part of the planet. They obviously did it from above somehow. What do you think? Well, if we've been to the moon, obviously we had sophisticated crap, but what do you think the planes look like? Because there have been, and you provided that too, sketches of what look like modern day airplanes.
Well, yes, there have been models found in Egypt and also in three Central American countries. In tombs from the past, going back thousands of years, which have been tested aerodynamically. In Saqqara, there were found, I think it was 14 models, and they gathered dust in a Cairo museum for many years, and then they were brought out and tested by aeronautical experts, and they took models of what they found, made replicas of them, and they flew. They were able to fly them. They glided perfectly. And so they were made with knowledge of aerodynamics, and these were going back 2,000 or 3,000 years in Egypt. We have similar models, but made of metal, in tombs from Colombia and other places. And these also have been tested by American military experts who say that these are not models of birds or flying fish, they're models of aircraft. They have cockpits in them, they have all sorts of things that today we use but birds don't have.
Something big happened, something major happened. What do you believe then kicked up so much dirt to bury these objects thousands and thousands of feet deep below the planet?
Well, if this disaster was a global, it would certainly be intercontinental, and seas and land would be churned up together, George. What we've got evidence of here on hundreds of thousands of hilltops, perhaps I could mention this, is that there are mass burial graves on every continent. There's not one continent that doesn't have these, and they're on hilltops and mountaintops, where you have thousands of animals and trees and sea creatures all buried and mixed up together, their bones all in a mass and concreted over by natural concretion processes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are being found, not just a few hundred mountains, hundreds of thousands have been found worldwide. And they show that somewhere, somebody was fleeing from a disaster. Animals were fleeing. But how did the whales and the sharks get mixed up with them? In other words, there was land and sea all being churned up together, and they were buried and cemented together eventually.
Can you imagine what the sound might have been of this planet being churned around the way it was? I mean, it must have been deafening.
Oh, it must have been. And water travels, and the sound travels so much louder through water.
The people who must have gone through this, you talk about frightening.
Yeah, they must have been going through a nightmare. And when they came out of it, there was a great fear of it. We have legends. We can go back to our ancient recorded history of our ancestors, and on all races there's a memory of an event that had such a tremendous impact on them that they had fear in their stories that they recorded, as though they had personally been survivors. With that, stories were told with such awe-struck impressiveness. Now, we go to geology and we find physical evidence that something did happen, and it was global. And in India, you have 10,000 feet of water-laid sediment, and there's no rivers that could have brought them. This is all high stuff. And there's no natural process today that can make sediment like that. There's no natural process that can make coal fields that are thousands of feet deep today.
With people's body parts in them.
Yes, and with the bits of machinery and pots and jewelry and so on all mixed up with people, yes.
That's something. You talked last hour about the Andes Mountains and about a ship. Why don't you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Oh, yes. The Andes Mountains, for a start, are fairly young by the legends of the people in South America. They say they came up in a day and a night, and I would say that this could have happened because there was a great readjustment of the Earth's surface for hundreds of years after the Great Flood. And there was time for migration to take place and for cities and towns and villages to be built. And the convulsions continued for some time. Now, there's a city up near Lake Titicaca, and Titicaca is an interesting place. That's where the floating islands are, where the people live on these grass islands that float around, and the wind blows them around. They've got
right.
glass houses and grass boats and so on.
Yeah.
And the boats are very similar to those in the ancient Egyptians used to have, grass boats. Now, 12 miles south of Lake Titicaca, and by the way, Lake Titicaca is a beautiful lake. It's got a massive flamingos. You can look out from the shore of the lake and see all this pink amongst the blue, and it's all these beautiful, long, necked flamingos altogether there. Beautiful. But anyway, south of there, 12 miles, there is the remains of a city. The name it's given today is Tiwanaku. That may not have been its original name, but that's what we identify it by today. That city is in ruins. Much of it was destroyed by the Spaniards for building the railroad and other things when they took over. But prior to that, there were many beautiful statues and lovely buildings and gates, but they were in ruins. Now, to the south, not facing Lake Titicaca, but to the south, away from the lake, there are huge ship quays where big ships used to come in and dock. And the iron circles for them to tie in and thread their ropes around to keep the ship close are still there. Now, the native people who live a little further inland say that in a day and a night, the whole Andes Mountains rose from sea level. Here you've got a seaport 12,000 miles above sea level today, which was probably right on the Pacific coast at the time. And behind that, you've got still some mountains, and you've got a shoreline, a sandy shoreline with seaweed and seashells still looking fairly fresh at a level of 12,000, 1 or 200 feet.
My, oh my.
So something happened there.
It's something dramatic. To move ships, to embed them in mountainsides, to find people thousands of feet, but remains of people thousands of feet down. It really is. It's shocking to imagine what could have occurred during that period.
Yes, and this is in historical times, George. We're not talking about millions of years here. These things are fresh. And we've got the memory of it in the minds of tribes that still survive in the area.
Jonathan, does the Bible echo any of this?
The Bible does give us a very interesting account of the Great Flood and gives a log, actually, a day-by-day log of events, as though somebody was keeping a ship's log when they were surviving this, waiting to get out. After so many days this happened, then after so many days they did this, and so on, while they're inside it. So that's an interesting story.
So you believe that the great flood that's illustrated in the Bible, that might have occurred during this catastrophe?
I believe it could have been the same catastrophe.
Oh, that's great. That is a fascinating story, too, all by itself. And it also tells you a little bit about some of the humans that were saved, Noah and his family. And though it may have been symbols, too, it may have been a real event with symbols of the ark. Is that possible?
Well, the symbols actually are probably based upon real events. Yeah, symbols. There were certainly symbols. When you go down to Turkey today, you'll notice that the Turkish government has declared an area a historical park, and they call it the Noah's Ark Park. The interesting thing about that region is that Well, archaeologists as a whole tend to put a lot of weight upon place names. Now, in America, I know over here in New Zealand we do this, a place name sticks from a historical event, and in America you do the same, don't you?
Oh, sure do, yep.
And in Turkey, in this whole area, there's it's a place called the Place of Eight, which reflects back on the eight human survivors in the Noah's survival vessel. Then you've got a place called Where the Crow Cannot Land, reflecting back to the biblical story of the crow that was sent out to see how much land was now reappearing above the water, and it couldn't find a place, so it flew back. And you've got a village saying this is the place where it happened. Then you've got another mountain just close by there which says this is where the boat flowed over. In other words, the mountain's named after the flowing over of the boat. Then you've got another place name which says here is where one of the anchor stones was dropped. And it's interesting that there's a lot of ancient, going back thousands of years, folklore in that region about the landing of the big boat up in the mountains.
How many people do you think were on the planet at this time, 5,000 years ago?
Possibly in the billions. I would think would have to be. We're finding evidence of human remains worldwide, deep under, so it probably might have even been similar to our population, George. Who can tell? But I'd say it was a pretty sophisticated and well-developed civilization. There must have been a lot of people.
Cremo talked about these small metallic spheres, hundreds of them, that were found deep, deep within the planet, too.
Yes, down in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many interesting things being found. Down in Europe, quite a number of things, too. Pieces of machinery have been found underground, way down underneath the coal.
Have you sent our webmaster this picture yet of this machine you were talking about?
No, I haven't, because I'm nowhere near the computer, I'm sorry, but I will do it straight after the broadcast.
Okay. If you can, how much time do you need to do it? Could you do it in 3 minutes or something like that?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Well, why
would
don't
you want me to do it during one of the breaks?
Yeah, well, you can do that at the top of the coming hour. Not this break that's coming up in a minute, but right at the top of the hour, you will have about a five-minute time period to send it to Lex and then rush back to your phone so you don't miss the rest of the interview. Want to do that?
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, and we'll have him posted. I am curious about this piece of machinery that you said was found on a military installation. Is there a story around that found?
There is a story, and if I can pick up the story, I'll send that along with it.
Okay, we'll do that. And when we come back, we'll continue this hour our discussion with Jonathan Gray. His website is called archaeologyanswers.com. That's very easy to remember, archaeologyanswers.com. His book is called Dead Men's Secrets. We'll be back in a moment at the top of the hour. Jonathan, is there any evidence that shows or proves that the calamity that you say occurred 5,000 years ago, that it might have been ongoing, that maybe we had one 50,000 years ago, a million years ago, or do you think this one was just a one-time event?
My own personal view is it's just a one-time event, George, but we do have a good evidence for it, very good evidence. And I think that if we focus on that evidence, we've got an explanation of everything we've had happening since.
Let's talk a little bit more about that evidence, some of the things that you say back us up in terms of this theory. What might it be?
Well, what we have here is an interesting time synchronization of the physical features of the Earth. If we go, for example, to waterfalls and coral reefs and so on, we find a very similar age being confirmed for these. Would you like me to go into some of those?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure. Thank you.
Okay. We've got, for example, inland seas, they're gradually shrinking. They've been shrinking for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years. Even in our lifetime, the Caspian Sea and the Aral Sea and others have been measured in their shrinking. They've retreated several miles. Studies of salt and mineral deposits in numerous such lakes suggest that none of them is older than about 4,000 years. Now, river deltas, the Mississippi. Now, the Mississippi's got 80,000 tons of rubbish an hour coming down, and I shouldn't say rubbish, 80,000 tons of silt and so on coming down an hour.
Sludge, as we call it.
Sludge. And the Nile, the Volga, all the great rivers of the world, they all show evidence that they're not older. These deltas are not older than about 5,000 years old if you take them back. You go to Niagara Falls, the waterfalls of the world, and the present channel that's been cut into the falls by the water has been measured and said to be less than 4,500 years old. We come down to Australia, the Great Barrier Reef. And by the way, coral, George, grows like tree rings. It's building up all the time, and it can be measured.
Yeah,
and
it's a barometer of time, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And the average growth at half an inch a year makes the Great Barrier Reef 4,330 years old. Now, trees, the oldest trees that can be confirmed for age are between 4,000 and 5,000 years old. And I know that something a little older than that has been speculated for bristlecone pines, but you have to synchronize all the trees and find that they are around about the same age. Sometimes in 1 year, you'll get up to 5 rings on one tree. That's not generally known. Or even if a tree is growing on the side of a hill, on one side, it might have 2 rings grow the 1 year and 1 ring the next. It depends upon climatic conditions and the interchange of dry and hot during the same year even. But generally speaking, in stable conditions, it's usually one ring a year.
Jonathan, do some mainline scientists talk about this? Are they puzzled that it looks like everything is directly channeled to 4,000 to 5,000 years ago? Or do they just pass on that?
Well, a lot of scientists are not aware of the pattern. I'm a pattern man because it started with my technology discoveries that there was a pattern worldwide, but there was a certain resemblance between all of the technology in every continent. So I started looking at it as relating to the disaster that wiped out civilization, and I found there's a pattern here too. Most scientists specialize in deserts or trees or coral reefs, but they don't look at the pattern overall. But it's when you bring the pattern together, you begin to see something interesting. The Potsdam Institute for Climate Research in 1999 came to the conclusion that the oldest desert in the world is only 4,000 years old. Now, you don't get a desert underneath a flood, underneath water. It's only when the water goes away the desert starts growing.
That's right.
And a very interesting thing occurred. By the way, glaciers, ice, and so on. The Rhone Glacier has been measured at 4,875 years. All the European Alps have lost half their ice in the past 100 years, so ice doesn't have to be tens of thousands of years old. The ice of Greenland is an interesting one. A friend of mine was talking to a guy who salvaged the some planes that were left there after Second World War. They were called the Lost Squadron, and maybe some of the listeners are familiar with this story. But
I remember this, yeah. Go ahead again, though.
Yeah. You see, by looking at all the rings in the ice in Greenland and Antarctica, there are about 30,000 rings in Greenland, for example. You would guess from that that the ice had been there 30,000 years, but not so. It's been speculated, and this is in scientific journals, that the ice is like a tree ring. You have summer and winter, and so it builds up, and you've got 30,000 years of ice. Now, the man who recovered one of these planes from Greenland, he said that his team went up there in recent years to retrieve these planes and found that they were 186 feet under the ice. And my friend spoke to him and said, now, did you notice any rings in the ice as you went down? He said, yes, we did. There are thousands and thousands of those rings.
Thousands, that's amazing.
But my friend said, but wait a minute, aren't those annual rings? He says, no, not in your life. They're not annual rings. You can get several rings in a week. It's just the change, a warmer period, a colder period, and the ice builds up constantly because it's always blowing. So 30,000 rings does not mean 30,000 years. And 186 feet down had thousands of rings in just, what, 50 years, 60 years? So we can't go by rings to make glaciers, but the Rhone Glacier and all the glaciers of the world are no older than 5,000 years, according to the latest research.
And whatever it was, it must have been so big because it's all around the planet.
Yes, so big. Now, a gentleman by the name of Dr. George Dodwell, he was the Astronomer Royal in Adelaide, Australia, and he did research into the observations of the planets and their moons over the last 3,000 years, and he discovered that the observations, which were very accurately made in China, Europe, Middle East and so on over this period, all agreed that the Earth was spinning like a top and that it was adjusting itself from a disruption that occurred violently at a certain date. And he plotted this on a curve and sent his results to other scientists who were able to confirm that his calculations were correct. And he said something tipped the Earth on its axis in the year 2345 BC. His name is Dr. George Dodwell. So he gave a date, a scientific date for it.
He said 2345 BC or 1000 BC?
2345 BC, which is about, what, 4,500 years ago.
2345. 2,345. Okay.
Yeah,
I see
that's
what
right.
You mean. Okay. I thought you were saying 2345. No.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. It's remarkable. I mean, everybody seems to have the same date.
Well, it's coming from all types of clocks, as you might say. Something big happened between 4,000 and 5,000 years ago. It was a global thing that happened.
Well, let's hope that never happens again.
Yeah.
Are you aware of some rocks in Peru that show ancient technology carved on them? They've got, like, surgeries, machines. They're called Icahua rocks, ICA. And there's no way anybody did that now as a joke. I mean, these things are thousands of years old.
Yes, I haven't seen them personally, George, but I'm familiar with them. I've seen photographs of a number of them and the stories behind them. And I believe that these show evidence of being genuine. And yes, there was too many of them just to be hoaxes. Who would go to the trouble of wasting his whole life just doing that for nothing?
Explain a little bit more now for us, Jonathan, now that we've got a clear picture of what might have happened. How we got the survivors and how many you think there might have been?
Well, if we go to ancient records, the Aborigines say there was one group of survivors. So do certain tribes of American Indians, and so do various other cultures. That's one thing they have in common, that there was one group of survivors. Now, I'm not going to contradict what our ancestors are handing down to us, because they live closer to the events. And I know a lot of people would say, but there must have been lots of different survival vessels.
Right.
Well, my question is, can we be sure of that? Or should we rather go with what we're being told by our ancestors who live near the event?
I would tend to listen to the ancestors, wouldn't you?
They tend to be closer, and they tend to know more than we do often.
True.
Now, the Bible also says there was one group of survivors. And if you're talking about a survival vessel, this is something that I've got into more recently and found to be extremely fascinating, that many modern shipbuilders have gone to the book of Genesis to study the remains of that survival vessel that old Noah was in.
Based on the specifications.
And based on that specifications, they've given us the types of boats we have today that are the best for the worst conditions at sea. Well, it looks like we've got to lift that ark out of the realm of a fanciful tale into the realm of a accurate scientific report. We've got dimensions there that stand up scientifically better than any dimensions in the past. So it looks like we're having eyewitnesses here who are writing that story.
And it doesn't sink.
Doesn't sink. It would roll, the waves would roll over it, but it was built to withstand the worst of storms and to survive it.
How much knowledge do you think we lost, Jonathan, when this happened?
Most of it, I think, George. What was left was probably just an echo of what used to be. I don't know how... Suppose our civilization was destroyed now and there was a group of survivors. They wouldn't take on board one fraction of what's available in our world today. They'd have to start from scratch at a much lower level, even if it was sophisticated. And I believe this is what we look at when we see Egypt and Samaria and so on.
Do you believe, Jonathan, that we had this one major catastrophe that wiped out this high technology civilization around this planet? Or might we have had several others before that and something happened to them too?
Well, you know, it's interesting to speculate, but once again, I have to go to the evidence, and I'm not going to dispute one way or another as to what might have happened, but I do know that this one did happen. And it was so widespread, it just destroyed so much and left its evidence for us to study.
I very, very would like to hear your thoughts on what you think occurred.
Well, perhaps I'll try to describe this event as I see it, perhaps. As far as the physical events, I would like to do it that way, if I might.
Okay, and let's assume some people are on the planet when this is occurring.
Yeah.
What are they doing? What's happening to them?
Well, you'll have people doing business deals in the big cities. And possibly on the TV news, there's stories of these warnings of what's coming, and people dismiss it like they do today. You go to Mount St. Helens, and a lovely gentleman was about 20 miles away from the mountain, and the reports kept coming that the mountain was about to blow up, and he says, I'm sitting here, I've lived here all my life, and nothing's happened. And he's now under the ash.
Deep.
Yeah, deep. And it probably happened with these people. And there were children at school, and probably when the event began, the headmaster called all the teachers together, the teachers called the children together, says, go home and be with your parents, we don't know what's going to happen. And that's the last day that school ever existed again. We're dealing with human lives here that were affected and that never survived it. But what actually are we seeing? We're seeing an external force that tipped the earth on its axis, changed the climate in a flash, reversed the land and water ratio, so it's now more water than land, virtually wiped out the world's population, and we're inhabiting a world that is damaged and impoverished with deserts and ice and still suffering the effects of some great disaster.
And buried it by thousands of feet, right?
Buried it, yeah. Now, here's my scenario. This force coming close to the Earth would have generated high-speed ultra-vibrations, I believe, within the crust of the Earth. And the finely tuned balance was suddenly disrupted. And under the Earth, we've got fire and we've got water basins, enormous ones. And these were suddenly broken up, and the pressure underneath became enormous as the cracks came into the crust. And the huge granite crust exploded. Jets of water possibly shooting 70 miles or 100 miles into the canopy, and the canopy beginning to collapse as water in a disastrous rain. Water coming from under the ground, water coming from above, the atmosphere.
And the sky must have been blocked out the sun for years.
Oh, yes, it must have been. And there's evidence that the Earth's crust has been violently scoured several miles deep, and water-laid sediment filling up those scours. Evidence that animals and people were fleeing together to great heights and that they were trapped. It certainly was not the survival of the fittest, George. You've got young and old, fit and unfit, all mixed up together, thousands of feet up, washed into crevices with debris washed over them, land and sea creatures mixed together. You'll see this in France, Gibraltar, Lebanon, North America, South America, Australia, China, India, Africa. It's a global phenomenon, all driven together, all smashed to pieces.
Did it happen in one day?
It probably took weeks.
Weeks, okay.
As it kept rising and rising, and new every new day, probably the waves would be coming higher and higher through the continents. But a mass extinction in all parts of the world, sudden burial. Oh, let me tell you about this one, a whale on its tail. This one sort of tickles me a bit.
And you know, they just found a whale skeleton in the desert, in Egypt.
In Egypt. Well, look at that. It's land, but the sea was over there.
Yeah.
Up there, now what's the name of this place? Lompoc. It's a little town northwest of Los Angeles, close to the coast, but it's mountainous there. And there's a quarry been going there for a few years. They've been quarrying the, what do they call them, little sea creatures that just about comprise the whole mountain. Diatoms, I think, aren't they? Diatoms, yeah.
Oh, yes, yeah, yeah.
And in the middle of the whole thing, what should they come up against as they exposed the mountain, inside the mountain? Here was a baleen whale, 80 feet long, standing upright on its tail, covered by a mountain. Now, whatever did this was so powerful, it buried the thing before it could even fall over and just covered the whole thing and put it there.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Now, when we see these evidences, George, to me it's like showing us. Now, if we go down to Egypt today, we see the pyramids. We see the great statues. We see the Sphinx and so on. And what we are looking at is evidence forensic evidence, maybe, of a wonderful nation of the past. If we go to the world around us, we see evidence of the great events of the past, like the Great Flood. Forensic evidence.
Well, we're going to talk about buildings. Do you think they had large buildings? We'll chat about that when we come back, Jerry. Jonathan, I've got to ask you this, though. They either had, if you believe in this high-tech society that they once had, that they could have had the Star Wars-type living environment where they lived in, small stone houses and huts and things like that, or do they have the elaborate skyscrapers that we have today that simply is buried underneath thousands and thousands of feet of dirt and things like that? What do you think it was?
Well, George, considering the other parts of technology we've discovered, and by the way, I have emailed those other two pictures to you now.
Okay.
I will go for the latter option, that they did have the ability and the desire to really make a magnificent show of themselves, because what we have got is sophisticated already, just these small things we find, and the big one I've just emailed. But, yes, big buildings, and soon after the flood, they were constructing enormous buildings, so I guess they had it in their blood.
Okay, so you're saying that thousands of feet underground, buried, could be skyscrapers?
Quite easily, I would accept that, yes. Wouldn't surprise me at all. But we're not going to have a large find, I don't think. We're not going to have a lot of finds, because today, unfortunately, we're mining in a different way than we did, say, 100 years ago. We began about 150 years ago to find these things buried. Now it's done by machinery, and human first-hand eye-to-eye labor is not what it used to be. We're now at a distance, and we're going to miss a lot of stuff that we would have found if we kept using 18th-century technology.
And it's also possible, though, Jonathan, these buildings, these huge skyscrapers, could have toppled too, right?
Oh, I'd be surprised if they didn't, yes. When you've got great tsunamis sweeping across and huge mountains of soil and rocks being redistributed and forests being bombarding cities and so on and burying people, you're not going to have much left standing, that's true.
All right, as soon as Lex has posted the pictures that Jonathan has just sent him, I'll let you know, and you can go to the coasttocoastam.com website and take a look at some of this ancient machinery that was found. Let's go to the phones. Yeah.
Yeah, George, could I make a suggestion about my website, too? Rather than people finding archaeology answers, which some are going to spell it all different ways, could I just make a quick suggestion?
Yes, sir.
I've got a shortcut to my site as well, from your site or from wherever, and that is beforeus.com. Just before us.
That's it?
BEFOREUS.com points to archaeology answers and gets you there.
All right. More work for Lex to post that as well, and we will do it, because I'm sure you're getting slammed on your website right now, Jonathan. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Get us going. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Jonathan. This is John calling from Lima, Ohio.
Hi, John.
Hi. I heard you mention about Neil Armstrong and the moon shots that we are said to have made. And my grandfather worked with Neil Armstrong's father. And from what I believe, they got up there and saw something. And, you know, was told not to say anything about what they had seen. But, you know, the ultimate irony in all this is that in the three moon theories, the one theory that justifies us making a trip to the moon in the near future is the hoax theory that we never went to begin with.
Yeah, I believe we went, though.
I do, too.
Yeah.
But the thing is that, you know, why go back there if we're just going to cover it up? You know, why put people's lives at risk and use public money, you know, if we're just going to cover it up?
Good question, John. I agree with you.
And we're talking about going back in 2015. Mm-hmm. One would say, my God, during the 1960 technology, we were able to get to the moon, haven't been there in 36 years, won't be there for another 5, 6, 7, 8 years. Why?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and if you go by the theory that we went up there and saw nothing, then that really doesn't justify a return trip either. It's the hoax theory that, you know, that says we never went there to begin with that would justify us making another attempt.
Yeah, no, you're right about that, though. I do believe that we did go, and Jonathan, I'm sure you believe we went as well, don't you?
I believe we got there, yeah.
All right, next up, first-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there. Hello? Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yes, my question is, in the book of Genesis, it had mentioned, even according to Zechariah Sitchin, that the earth became void. Because I know that your guest was talking a little bit earlier about that there might have been a catastrophe that happened on Earth, here on Earth before. And what was his response to that in reference to the book of Genesis where it talks about regeneration?
Okay, yeah, good, interesting question. That's only in the English. In the original Hebrew, which can be checked on, you'll find that the word used for was void actually means was. It doesn't mean became. And the word replenish in the English version does not mean refill. It simply means fill. The Hebrew is more precise than the English. I think in the English you don't have any problem with became void because it just says was void. But with the word replenish, it does mean in the original Hebrew fill. In other words, you can have an empty place to start with that's never been filled before, and you simply fill it.
Okay, thanks for your phone call. Appreciate your input. Let's go next to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good. Where are you calling from?
This is Adam. I'm calling from Decatur, Illinois.
Okay, Adam. Go ahead.
I actually had a question for you, Jonathan. I was wondering, like, all the structures that are on Mars, for example, like the face on Mars and pyramids and whatever else is out there, I was wondering if you think that that could have been made by an ancient civilization here on Earth or if it was ancient civilization on Mars.
My view is that it could have well been made by an ancient civilization on Earth. The structures, if they are such, we won't know till we get there for sure, but they do point that way, are in harmony with the structures we've made here on Earth.
Okay, great. Well, that's all for now. I appreciate it. And, George, I love the show. I'm a long-time listener.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you being part of the program. And, you know, Jonathan, when you started doing this investigation, as you began to unravel things, was there one thing that you found that just boggled your mind that continues to perplex you?
Yes. I'm not quite sure, actually. There's quite a few things, I suppose. The one thing that boggles me is really how it has not even entered into the school syllabus or the school curriculum. We're taught repeatedly that we're the brainiest lot of people that have ever been on this planet. Our scientists are the best who ever lived, bar none, and that man in the past was just simply coming out of a cave where he dragged his woman round by the hair and beat her with his club, and gradually, and he was grunting as he chewed on raw bits of old meat. And then suddenly he woke up to the idea of this and that and became civilized, and now we're still getting that more that way. No, history doesn't show it that way at all. As far as I can see, the evidence shows that we were pretty much with the DNA programming that we've got today, and that no information has been added to our DNA. We've got evidence of very high sophistication as far back as we can go.
All right, let's go. Lexa sent me a message with your pictures, so they're posted on the coasttocoastam.com website. Here are his instructions. You click on the lens photo on the homepage or the link that says here and the paragraph beneath the picture. Then when you get to the page, scroll down to see the new images. that Jonathan has sent along with his description, and you might have to hit the refresh button. So there's Lex instructions to take a look at this machinery, which I have got to go look at myself because I bet it's pretty darn fascinating. Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
This is Olin in Culver City, California.
Sure, Olin. Hi.
The seaport that's high in the Andes Mountains, that could have been pushed up by a gigantic asteroid bashing out the Pacific Ocean basin and slowing down into Earth orbit, forming the moon. The huge tsunami wave could have swept whole forests of trees into mountain valleys 1,000 feet deep, where the pile of trees turned into coal beds. So the moon should have part of the ancient Earth on it. So I'd like to know if Jonathan has ever considered a giant asteroid collision with the Earth.
Well, that's what we were talking about. I think maybe that happened. Your take on that, Jonathan?
Oh, yes, I wouldn't discount that. I think, however, the event was bigger, and the evidence does show that there was something bigger than just a tsunami that was involved as a result.
I'm looking at this picture, Jonathan, of this incredible machine, and you say that it dwarfs the dumpster on the left side. I can't see the dumpster from this picture. Maybe it was cropped off. What do you think this machine might have been used for?
Oh, your guess is as good as mine, George. If you told me it was used for something, I couldn't deny it. I don't know what it was. It's a big mystery.
It looks like it ate part of the Earth or something. Is that possible? It looks like something that would just keep digging.
It could have been a big digging instrument. Might have been a tunnel boring instrument or something. Or who knows? I'm mystified by it. I would really love to have examined it before it was buried, but it's just like most of these things are found. You get a report in Scientific American once, maybe one paragraph, and then it disappears, is buried or destroyed.
What is this machine made out of? Do you know?
I don't know. I do know that other pieces of machinery that have been found do show sophisticated alloys. Alloys, for example, like titanium and various space-age metals that we use today. In other words, they were advanced in how they did it.
And the machine was covered with these very strange inscriptions, right?
Yes, and the inscriptions have not been able to be deciphered. They have similarities to some languages after the flood, but here it's got something before which no one can really decipher.
It looks pretty alien to me, to tell you the truth. Hmm. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George and Jonathan, an honor to speak to you both.
Thank you so much, yeah, and where might you be?
My name is Mike, and I'm calling from Oliphant, Pennsylvania. I'm also a StreamLink member, and you might know me better, George, as Rack Attack. I don't know if you could.
Sure thing. Absolutely.
Okay. I'm also listening in on WILK Network in Oliphant, Pennsylvania.
Sure.
Okay, my question is dealing with the Taklamakan Desert. It's north of India. I was wondering if Jonathan has any knowledge of this. Do you know that program that you were talking about one time? That you can look at cities, you can zoom in up on cities, George?
Yeah, TerraServe.microsoft, yeah.
Well, it's a similar program that I was looking at one day, and I happened to look at the globe from a long distance away. I don't know if you want me to give that address out or not. It's a different type of program other than TerraServer, but it's the same kind of thing. Do you want me to give that or no?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, it's keyhole.com, www.key, as in, like, if you turn a key, hole, H-O-L-E.com.
Okay.
And it actually has a 7-day free trial. You can probably try it out. I don't have nothing to do with them, but that's where I found this at. I was looking at the globe as a whole, and I happened to look at the Taklamakan Desert north of India. And it's an elliptical-shaped desert. And when I was looking at it, it looked awfully much like a glancing blow asteroid strike. And if you look at it, it looks like the asteroid might have came from the east, hit the planet at a glancing blow, and went to the west, and throwing off, like, a lot of desert and debris. And that's where all the deserts come from the west of the Taklamakan Desert. So I was wondering if Jonathan has any knowledge of this, might think that there was some sort of an asteroid blow that caused the Taklamakan Desert. And also I wrote to the USGS and I asked them about this, and they said it was formed through other means. But they said that elliptical craters are uncommon. But I checked on the internet and I found out that they're pretty common. And as a secondary note to this, a couple of explorers went through the Taklamakan Desert, and I don't remember their names. It was a while back, and there's not much information on the internet about the Taklamakan Desert. But supposedly, under the sands of the Taklamakan Desert, there are entire cities, a lot of talk about gold, golden cities, things totally intact, shoes, dishes, pottery, that often get uncovered.
How deep under do you think they are? Well, we lost him. Go ahead, Jonathan. Have you heard about this desert at all?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the desert, and some very interesting finds have been made there, Mike. Not least of which is a document which describes every one of the planets as though it would be seen by an astronaut. In any case, there was an advanced civilization there, no question. And there have been asteroid hits of the Earth over the last few thousand years. So it's quite possible that everything you were just saying is quite correct, and that there was a civilization, there have been civilizations wiped out in recent times. Are we talking about the Great Flood? We're talking about civilizations that have been wiped out since, and I'd say this was one of those that were wiped out since.
Isn't this interesting, as you pointed out, that a lot of this is very similar to what Velikovsky thought about when he was writing his works some time ago?
Oh, yes. Catastrophism is the pattern worldwide. This idea that everything has continued on without a break, and then that the present is the key to the past, you can throw that out the window when you look at the evidence. There has been catastrophe right through history.
First time caller line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Is this me?
It is.
Oh, hi. My name's Wanda. I'm calling from Los Angeles.
Hi, Wanda.
My question, I'd like you to talk a little bit about Malta. And as I understand it, I think I've heard, I could be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that the conservative scholarship has dated these temples a couple thousand years before the period you're talking about. And I was also wondering about the idea that perhaps these very ancient and advanced cultures maybe were operating on a different mindset, like Julian Jaynes' Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind a little bit talks about. Perhaps they had advanced technologies that were more right-brained, so that it wasn't so much this kind of technical and complex hardware that they were building, but that their mind, possibly they could move objects because their mind was active in different ways in this glaciational cultures. Anyway, I just wondered about that idea. But mostly I wanted you to talk about Malta, if you could.
Malta?
Yeah.
Yes. In Malta, there are some very interesting remains. There's an underground tunnel system, and there are some very old temples. That's true. I haven't personally been to Malta, but I find it an interesting place to study.
Do you think that there are people, Jonathan, that are still living deep beneath the planet's surface?
There have been people reported who were living down under the surface, George. There is one tribe, in fact, who went down in the 1970s. 30,000 natives in South America went underground to escape the advance into their villages in the jungle of Westerners. And they're still there now.
How far down?
Not too far down, probably 20 or 30 feet below ground. And I have a friend who's actually been down there and spent time with them.
Wow. Stay with us. Well, I'm getting fast blasted with two different kinds of these insects, by the way, so I've looked at their pictures now. One group of people they're sending us called sow bugs, S-O-W-B-U-G-S. That looks very close to what I'm talking about, but the ones I'm talking about are what people have fast blasted me. They're called pill bugs. Pill bugs, that's exactly what they are. Let's go back to the phones with you, Jonathan Gray, and the rest of our callers. And by the way, Jonathan, I want to thank you for just a very enlightened show tonight. Fascinating subject, and you've done a great job. Thank you.
My pleasure to be with you, George.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast to Coast. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Burbank, California.
Ah, just like old home week for me.
Yes.
Go ahead.
This is Maharani. I love your show this evening. A great, great show.
Thanks.
I've always been curious, and I'm wondering if, Jonathan, you've come across any evidence that suggests parallel copies of the Alexandria Library or libraries of that nature that predate that, that would go back to the civilizations that you have been referring to this evening.
Am I getting the question right? Has anything survived from the Alexandrian libraries that relate to what we've been speaking of before the Great Master?
Well, that, and more to the point, other libraries like that one, any other vast libraries from antiquity that you may have seen evidence of having or do exist.
Oh, I see what you're saying, yes. Unfortunately, the way of history has been destruction. When the Westerners went across to the Americas, they destroyed all the writings that they could find. Just a handful of the Mayan writings survived. The same happened right through the Middle East, happened in Europe. Everywhere just about I've looked, library destruction, burning of libraries has taken place. The Alexandrian Library itself heated the swimming pools and the hot baths of Alexandria for 6 months. They burnt thousands and thousands of books in order to heat the swimming pools.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are about four places where there are believed to be writings that still exist that no one has access to. One is believed to be in Morocco, another in somewhere in Spain, one in Tibet, and then there are more writings in the vaults of the Vatican, and I understand that no one is privileged to see those either. There are certain things which are hidden for some reason or another. We don't know why, but these can only be rumored because we can't prove they exist.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate you being part of the program. Let's go next to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Yes. Earlier this evening, we were speaking about the moon thing and what might have been seen, and in private conversations with one of the astronauts who was on the surface, so I'll not use his name without his permission, but he spoke of seeing beings from other planets. And he said that there is no astronaut that's gone up that has not seen them, and that they had pictures and that they were told not to go back. I can't say that for myself, but I can just say that he does not say that in public much, but there have been people making references to it. The other thing I wanted to mention was, you mentioned the Ica stones. The surgeries on the Ica stones, I have seen those. They were not done with instruments. They were done with the it shows lines coming out of about the third eye area of people opening and sealing the incision. And they're coming, there's two people on either, one on either side of the person being opened up, and lines come out of the third eyes of both people, and they join in the middle and then go down to the patient. And the heart that they're holding up was drawn by somebody who definitely knew what a heart looked like. I mean, it was absolutely accurate. And others of the stones showed a man looking through a telescope looking object at the stars. There are two globes that are about knee high that show all the continents of the earth, but in a different configuration, more like Pangaea or Pangaea, whichever you prefer. And there also were pictures of men riding dinosaurs, and these men have larger heads and smaller legs and torsos than present-day people. They're a different proportion, very different-looking, but definitely humanoid-looking. And there's about 25,000 of them in the doctor's home, the doctor who found them. So, like you said, there's no one would spend their life doing that as a joke. But there's no way to tell when they happen. And near there on the beach, the guy found also dinosaur eggs. And I made mention one time, I don't know if it was on your show, George, or on
with Art,
one of the weekends, either Art or Barbara, I had mentioned that they found a Stegosaurus fossilized on the beach, and inside the rib cage, there was what appeared to be a human skull. And of course, someone called in and said, well, stegosaurus were vegetarian. Well, we don't know.
except for that human that got swallowed by this thing.
We don't know how that got there, and I'm not going to say that it was eaten. I'm just saying that it appears to be a human skull, and it appears to be inside the rib cage of a stegosaurus. So there's a lot of stuff out there that we just don't know.
It's the old ship in the bottle trick, isn't it?
Right. So
very interesting.
Thanks for bringing all this stuff out, Jonathan. I'm still trying to get your book from your website, and I hope to do that soon.
Okay, thank you.
Nice speaking with you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. By the way, where do you get your book, Jonathan?
Where can we get it?
Yeah.
Where can the listeners get it?
Mm-hmm.
www.beforeus.com. And then scroll down. There's about six or seven places on the website where you can just do a click here and go through to order if you wish.
Okay, next up, let's go to our wild card line. Your turn, you're on with Jonathan Gray on Coast to Coast. Hi there. Hello? Going once.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Oh, good. Hi, this is Corey from Phoenix and on KFYI. And I wanted to thank Jonathan for all of his books. I've read the Dead Man's Secrets and the Ark of the Covenant, and I'm very impressed. I wanted to ask Jonathan, were you part of the research or personally involved in being there with the research that you disseminated with the book Ark of the Covenant?
I've had my own team in Israel, in Jerusalem, and we have been working in with various people who are privy to the events going on, and our purpose was to confirm something that had already been claimed to have happened. And we worked very, very close with the people involved.
It was so fantastic, the revelations that book brought out. I thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Jonathan, what do you do next in terms of your research? You don't stop. I'm sure you're not going to give this up yet.
Well, George, I'm working at the moment on a series of books which deal with the events. One book on the world before the great event, one book on the events of the great flood, and one on the geological and sociological repercussions of the great flood that survive into our society for today. In other words, how the history of the world up to our day is affected by that event that happened in the past. I'm working on that at the moment.
Mention that website again. Was it beforeus.com?
Yes, beforeus.com. beforeus.com.
All right. It's getting slammed. It may be a little slow, people, but keep at it. You'll get in there eventually. Next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with Jonathan Gray. Hi there.
Hey, how are you? This is Nathan. I'm glad. I'm calling from Columbus, Ohio. I had a question for both of you. If either of you had heard of and read the Book of Mormon, because Professor Gay, you had spoken a lot about various calamities that happened in the Americas, and this book is a record of the ancient inhabitants there. And I was amazed, like, a lot of times it spoke of mountains being made where lakes had been and bodies of water where there had been land. I was wondering what you guys thought about that.
Well, globally, that situation has been going on for thousands of years. There's been tremendous upheavals, and we just had one end of last year, as we know, killed 300,000 people. America was included in that, and the legends of the world are full of it.
Jonathan, you kind of hint at a widespread cover-up about some of this. How come?
Well, yes, George. That's a subject on its own, the cover-up situation. Perhaps I should make a comment or two on that. Today we have a society in which we've got, it's got a monopoly on the teaching system. But wherever I go, I find people who come up with anything different being slammed down and denied their positions in the universities and schools, and even being discredited. In Australia, there's a man called Val Osborne, for example. He found remains of Phoenician settlements and Phoenician and Egyptian remains in Queensland. And a university was sent up, they sent an archaeologist up to the area with instructions to come back with a report that nothing was there. And that's the report that was given over the media. And immediately he was discredited by the media. Prior to that, he was accepted. You've got Ed Conrad in America and his dealings with the Smithsonian Institute, where human remains have been found in coal. We've got Gary Vay talking about Oklahoma and the excavations there that were bulldozed by authorities, and even the owners who lived on the land were told not to interfere. We've got David Childress and his dealings with the Smithsonian. There's Martin Dutray in New Zealand, whose discoveries of Celtic remains in the north and very sophisticated remains dating before the Maoris has been covered up, and his life has been under threat. We've got dinosaur tracks in Texas, where human remains cross over dinosaur tracks. Human tracks and dinosaur tracks are superimposed in a strata that was freshly uncovered. And people came down with tools to try to destroy these things. Now, it seems that we've got a vested interest somehow. People wouldn't get so emotionally involved that they'd want to destroy findings unless there was some philosophy they were trying to protect, perhaps, and maybe degrees, reputations, and so on.
All right, next up, International Line as the time clicks. Go ahead.
Hi there, George.
Hi, you sound like you're in a jet.
No, I'm in a truck.
Okay,
my name's Sean calling from Edmonton, Alberta.
Okay, Sean, go ahead.
I just had a question for your guest. You were talking about the dimensions of the ark earlier, and I just wanted to ask him, does he believe that those dimensions, according to Genesis, are accurate, and that scientifically would be line up accurate with what the Bible says in Genesis? And my second question is, what's his take on about the lost city of Sodom and Gomorrah? And my third question would be, is scientists proved through the Space Hubble telescope back in the early 90s through top scientists that they were going to reveal literally hundreds of thousands of red giant stars and white dwarf stars, but Hubble apparently only discovered a few hundred. And what's his take on that? And
That's it. No more time. We got to get him to answer it or we're going to miss out.
Okay, the first question is, I do believe that there's enough scientific detail in the book of Genesis that we can place the Ark of Noah on a sound scientific basis as being, the figures are correct, and you can take that as something that shipping experts today would accept also.
They're good proportions. Sodom and Gomorrah, I don't know if you've touched on that. Have you?
Yes, sure. No, not in this broadcast, but Sodom and Gomorrah, yes. We've done investigation into numbers of ancient cities, and it is true that there are remains down in the Dead Sea area which answer to the description of ruins that have been turned to ash and are peppered with millions and millions of sulfur balls that are quite unlike anything else in sulfur form we've found near volcanoes or other places. I've spoken to geologists about this, and they say there's nothing like this. This is quite unique in the south of Israel.
Do you think that the planet then must have been at least 2,000, 3,000 feet less than what it is now, right?
There's evidence that the Earth has expanded, yes. There have been symposiums conducted in recent years with very good evidence, and I tend to agree with what they're trying to say.
Do you think the continents moved at all during this period, 5,000 years ago, or was that something that occurred billions of years ago?
I believe it's fairly recent. When you match up the strata of South America with that of Africa, they fit pretty nicely, but also there's evidence of very little erosion. If it had been millions of years back, the erosion would have been greater than it appears to be now. My theory would be this, that the crust of the earth was split asunder at the time of the Great Flood, but not separated, and that there have been continuing disasters, and probably within a few hundred years of that event, and this is borne out by our ancestors' memory of the event, there was a splitting of the continents, almost like the Invisible Hulk. You know the old television program, the Hulk? His body would suddenly expand and his shirt would rip apart. And an expansion of the Earth by whatever means, possibly a lessening of the field of attraction of the atoms. In other words, a deterioration in the attraction of the atoms would naturally cause every atom of this Earth to be an expansion. And that could very well have happened.
I am curious what other scientists say about your book, Dead Man's Secrets.
Well, yes, certainly I'm getting responses from them. And there is a good, strong number of scientists who are saying, hey, this is something we've got to investigate. And then there are others who just won't say anything.
Well, we've got so many things going on this planet, Jonathan, that mankind just doesn't know yet. But thanks to people like you who continue to do research, it keeps our minds open, I'll tell you that. I appreciate you being on the program, Jonathan.
It's been a pleasure, George. It was certainly a wonderful time for me to speaking with you.
Okay, good luck to you. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.